This programme was made with the support of Sound and Vision, Broadcasting Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.
Raised on songs and stories.
You're all very welcome to Raised on Songs and Stories here on Near 90 FM. My name is Gerry Cooley, and for the next half an hour or so, we're going to be travelling the highways and byways about Dublin City and County, meeting all sorts of people talking about all sorts of things. Songs, poems and stories, all about the good old days. And you never know, if you listen, you might hear somebody that you know. So get the kettle on, make yourself a cup of tea, put the feet up and sit back and enjoy yourself.
In the rare old time.
Our very first guest today is a man called David Carlisle, who was the proprietor of the Halfpenny Bridge Galleries, which was the last antique shop on Bachelor's Walk. Number 15, to be precise. I caught up with David in his shop on the week he was closing up after over 35 years in the antique trade in Dublin, and I asked him how it all began.
I started off in wholesale drapery at the age of 15, South William Street Warehouse, across the river. I'd swear my uncle, who got me into the business, bribed the owner to give me a job. A dozen shirts would cost, say, £2, 3 and 6. You couldn't make up your full dozen, so you had to give the guy 8 shirts. So you had to divide £2, 3 and 6 by 12 and multiply by 8, and that was done in your head. It wasn't easy. From there into the hotel business in the Hibernian as a trainee chef. I did that for 18 months, and in 1961, I was 19, I went away to France for a year and worked as a chef in the south of France. A chef I worked with in the Hibernian, the head chef was French, and two chefs from that part of France came over to work for work experience. Okay. And I got pally with them, and
away
I went. Yeah, for the summer season in 1961, I was 8 months out there.
Right.
So it was a great experience.
Where were the seeds sown for the antique business in your veins?
No feelings at all about antiques. After I came back, I was killing a bit of time before I went back over to France again. I was going to go back the following year to work on a yacht. I got a job in an antique shop. It was Marshall's Antiques, Monty Marshall in South King Street. And he was a well-known dealer, a real character, but a very, very clever dealer. He knew his stuff. I was doing that to kill a bit of time and earn a bit of pocket money more than anything else. So it wasn't really for the love of antiques. Over a few years, having fiddled around with other things, spent a while in London in the Portobello Road. It was about then I really got stuck into it full time. After a couple of years in London, working from a store, indoors, and there were great days. You could make a lot of money by doing that. Cool. One of my favourite stories, a woman sold me her husband's golf trophies, and off he went to sell them, not knowing that they were the perpetual trophies belonging to the golf club. And he fortunately found us before
you could sell them
we
all.
Could sell the trophies. He gave us our money back, and
she
the wife obviously wasn't too keen on golf.
So after spending a few years in Portobello on the knocker, as he described, going around from house to house, learning his trade in the antiques, he decided to come back to Dublin in 1969 to make a go of it. And it was the bank strike in 1970 that would be the catalyst for him moving down onto the retail side, front of the customers, selling off a stall in the Dandelion Market.
69, then 70, there was a bank strike. And the money wasn't coming in. I was buying stuff for cash, putting stuff into Allen and Townsend's auction. You got a check back. I was importing Czechoslovakian glass. But all of this stuff had to be paid for. If I was getting checks that were unbankable because of the strike,
the cash flow dried up.
At that precise time, the Dandelion Market started. So this is my first foray into the retail. I was down on the second weekend with my stall, all the brass, all the glass, everything laid out, and everything sold. I came home with pockets full of money, absolutely plastered, wads of money onto the bed. There was very little brassware around, the coloured glass and all the bits and pieces that had been imported, and a few old bits, maybe a few bits of silver and stuff. There was just simply a great demand, and people seemed to want to get rid of their pound notes. During the day, I had to send a friend home in the car for extra supplies, and I had very, very little stock. What I would have had would have been a few hundred pounds in stock on the floor of our garage out in Churchtown. And then from there, after the bank strike, the Dandelion opened an indoor market. I went in there, but all they would give me was an upper story room, a lovely room on the first floor. But a lot of people just went in, browsed around the ground floor, and you couldn't get them up the stairs.
And after a brief spell up on Stephen's Green, David finally makes his way down to Bachelor's Walk, first to 19, and then he finally ends up in 15, where I was talking to him on that day. And he has a funny story from the time he was there, and I'll let Dave take up the story.
I bought this pit pony off a dealer in Harrogate, a stuffed one. Very, very realistic. Photo used to be stuck up there. I used to pull him out and tie him to the railings every day, and it looked very realistic. And people were ringing in to the RSPCA complaining about this. We used to do the horse show and the spring show. We had a little pitch. I decided at this horse show I'd bring down the pony and tie him to the to the corner of the stand. And an awful lot of people recognised it from the quays. But this fellow came along and he says, "I'm from the stand up around the corner." Says the RSPCA. Says, "Now that we've inspected it and pronounced it dead, we can close our file on it." So apparently they had to keep a note of all of the complaints, knowing that it was dead, but not having inspected it.
Right.
They had to keep a file open on it. Somebody else came along with a shovel of shite and put it under the pony one day. Another time I had an old lady come in the shop and chase me around with her umbrella, calling me a cruel old bastard for...
And she didn't know it was stuff.
No, and everyone in the shop kept stum, and they just enjoyed the bit of cracker swiping at me with her umbrella. And I'm sure she must have felt embarrassed when she found out her pony was stuffed.
And so we move from the antiques trade to the old Dublin taxi drivers. Now, I myself am a member of one of the oldest Dublin taxi driving families in Dublin. The Cooleys were out here in North County Dublin, and they're driving since the late 50s and still going strong today. My father, Gerard Cooley Sr., is always telling me about the rich and famous people that get in and out of his car and never give a tip. He reckons the meanest man in Ireland, I won't give you his name, he wears a wig, has a long nose, plays the Illan pipes with a very famous traditional Irish group in Ireland. And just to verify my father's feelings on the matter, a friend of this man, Garrick de Bruin, tells me that my father is absolutely 100% correct. Anyway, let's leave him alone and let's move on to the man we want to talk to today. His name is Paddy Greenhodge. Now, it's pronounced Greenhodge, but spelled G-R-E-E-N-H-A-L-G. H. Now, there's a H in there. I don't know whether Paddy brings it in or leaves it out. And he's from Raytown in Dublin. And if you don't know where Raytown is in Dublin, you're not a dub at all. So we talked to Paddy about an incident that happened up in his car, up in Stephen's Green. And I let Paddy take on the story.
The baby was born in Stephen's Green, in my car. The traffic was so bad at the time that I had to go on the footpath. I would think it was in Blue Caps at the time. And I got off at Mulby Park in Dundrum. And when I was kind of in the stress type of thing. So we got into the car, her and her husband got in the back, and off we went, where Hollis Street Hospital, as fast as you can.
Don't spare the horses.
Don't spare the horses. And it was about 10 o'clock, half 10 in the morning. When you get into Stephen's Green at that time in the morning, you can imagine the traffic. Now it was going back years, but still the traffic was bad on Friday morning. And I got down as far as Dawson Street, which you could go. And I was going to Hollis Street, up past the Shelbourne Hotel, and she started roaring. He said, "Oh my God, of course," but I won't say the course. And so, "What's wrong?" She's the baby. And I looked around and I seen the baby's head. And she said, "You'll have to stop." And I went up on the footpath and tried to get down, but some policemen were going to stop me up the road. He stopped me, and I'm doing this to the baby in the back, and he comes up and looks down. So the baby was born around Stephen's Green, but I kept driving. Bite in the head, and I got down to Hollis Street Hospital. pulled in, and the nurse came out. They were actually getting the radio from the police. She came out, and they took my car away and washed it clean. I don't think my car was as clean ever, but I didn't get paid.
The next item up is a very unusual one. It's a poem. It was given to me by a man called Noel Gurry from Bantry Road in Duncondra a couple of years ago. It's a poem by a man called F.X. Sherman, who was known in Dublin as the Docklands poet. Don't know much about him. Maybe I'll find some more out when I broadcast this. And this poem was printed in the press on the 12th of the 12th, 1969. And it's called Evolution, Me Granny. Now, I don't really have the Dublin vernacular for this, so I asked a friend of mine called Jembo the Dub, and he would be typical of the fellas you find in the pubs in Dublin who know the answer to everything. They've seen everything before, and they're the barflies who seem to be able to spend all their day there, still walk in and walk out as if they hadn't drank at all. I don't know where they get the strength from. But anyway, Jembo the Dub has agreed to recite this one for me in his best Dublin barfly accent. And the premise is that him and this other lad are sitting in a pub. The subject of evolution comes up. Evolution Me Granny, it's called. I'll hand it over to Jembo.
I was chatting to a fella in the boozer the other night, and he seemed like an educated sort of bloke. He wasn't just an ordinary 5'8er, do you know? And you could tell it the very minute that he spoke. He was talking on a subject that's miles above your head, but simple to a brainy bloke like me. Evolution, there's a queer one. I think that's what he said. Proves you're nothing but a bald-faced chimpanzee. Now it seems that no one knew this till 100 years ago, when a chimer they called Darwin found it out. And that's the reason there's some of us that sings just like a crow, and the others work like horses, there's no doubt. Another thing he told me, and this you can't deny, though it shook me when your man had proved his point. He asked me had it rained since the day me granny died. Are you codding me, says I, rained in this joint?
A bit of order there with the pitcher, give that man a chance. Bit of cuteness, please. Carry on, Jambo, you're doing a great old job.
Admit to me, they've buried her in the ground. I had no other option, it was true. Go up there now and dig her up and show me what you found. No dice, says I. I'll leave that all to you. You can't, said he. You've eaten her, like all of us around. Her poor old bones went rotten neath the clay, and the rain came down in buckets and seeped right through the ground. Washed her dear old granny right away. But this was not the last of her. Oh no, not in your life. She was hanging round the rivers with a still. When the sun came out and played in her, she went up to the clouds, and not for the first time in her life she was distilled. Then the farmer started moaning about their barley and their hops, and St. Peter taking pity on this shower, sent your granny back in liquid form to water all their crops. We might be drinking her this minute, me old flower. Just shows you now the truth there is in that old Irish saying that the longer you live, the more you eat. So remember your ancestors. You know now what I mean. The next time when the missus fills up your dinner plate. Evolution me granny. Jembo the Dub. Am I getting a few points for doing this? Anyway, stick them on, John. I'll have two, just in case.
Our next guest today is a man called Tommy O'Keefe, born in 1926 in Engine Alley over in the south inner city. He moved around from there, from Francis Street, Corn Market, then out to Clondalkin, then over the river to Dominic Street, and eventually settling in Duncondra, Welsh Road at the tender age of 5. Tommy's father was in the ESB. He had been previously in the British Army and served out in Mesopotamia, came home and joined the Irish Free State Army, and then eventually left there and then went to work in the ESB. And that's the reason why he moved around an awful lot as a young lad. He only had one brother, so there was two of them, a gentleman's family, as he described. And we got talking about the early days out in Duncondra. Now, the Cat and Cage is his local. He's been drinking there, wait for this, since 1945. Now, he's drank in other places, but he told me he had his very first pint in the Cat and Cage in 1945. Now, there's a good record for you. And I'm happy to report that he's still having his old pint there. I caught up with him one day in the Cat and Cage, big surprise, and we ended up in the cold room of the Cat and Cage, having a bit of an old chat. And we started talking about the very early days in Dunkondra, and Tommy told me all about his good friend Tommy Ridgway, and then he went on about the trams, and then he ended up with telling me a story that he used to diddle his mother out of the bus fare when he walked across town and bought a lead soldier with the halfpenny instead of going on the bus. So take it away, Tommy.
Did you have a best friend in school or a best friend on the road?
Yes, I'll tell you who it was. And I used to always say it's a joke. Tommy Ridgway. And his father, and the no Ridgway stores in Parnell Street. That's the same Ridgway. And I used to say as a joke to him, we never grew up together because we're the same height.
He's a vertically challenged.
Yeah. And we always went everywhere together, everywhere. He even came over to England with me to Liverpool.
Where would you go?
Well, most of the time when we played now in this time of the year when the kids are off school in the summer months, yeah. The park down at Griffith Park, that's where you spend most of the swimming battles there. Yeah. You could swim, and we used to do a little bit of gambling as well under at the trees. True as God. We used to build model aircraft. These were models you built from balsa wood. And you got plans, and you made an aircraft out of it. An elastic motor in it, like that. And we used to fly them in the park. At night time when the gardeners were gone. But you could buy the loose. I used to go out to a place in Townsend Street and you could buy your different types, sizes of balsa you wanted to buy. Long strips of it, sheets of it, you know, for various things.
And he's made aeroplanes?
Aeroplanes.
The hours of joy out of that.
Oh, it's marvellous.
Whose aeroplane was always the best?
Well, I wouldn't know that, tell you the truth. But,
do you remember an aeroplane crashing into something that shouldn't have crashed into?
Yes, definitely. And the Noah used to be the worst part of it, because when it landed, other kids would know to pick her up for you. So delicate.
They break the plastic.
You name it, yeah.
I then asked him, did he remember the time the trams used to pass by the Cat and Cage? And of course he said yes.
Yes. Yeah. And see this poor pair, this was the bottleneck, because it used to break out and it'd be an up and down track. But up to that point, from there up to, where would I say, past Home Farm Road, yeah, all the way up to the police station.
Yeah.
It was a single track and that used to be the terminal.
Oh,
and then the conductor or the driver get out and pull the boom down.
Yeah.
We often give them a hand doing it, pull the boom down and track her up, and then he'd come down. And then when it became past the Cotton Cage here, became a double track, right, an up and down track.
Understand.
Having that time sheets right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But they didn't miss each other.
No.
And how much was it at the town on this ramp?
Well, I remember going in for a penny halfpenny into Nelson's Pillar. No, that's, you're going into town to see any of the pictures in town, you know, at the time.
And what age were you did your mother let you go into town on your own?
Well, I'll have told you, you wouldn't believe it. Would you believe, when I was in the communion class, I used to get the bus, it used to be like the Choi King Express, a little single decker buses at the time,
right.
And I had to go in there to Halton Street, on my own. Coming up to seven. Straight in. But what I used to do, I'll tell you the truth now, to be honest with you. I got me bus fare in and me bus fare out. And I'd be going up to go to Ann Street School. And used to be a shop there. And your man used to make these lead soldiers. Now, they weren't painted. But you get them, they were a halfpenny each, like that. And I used to spend me bus fare. I'd have to walk home.
Did your mother never cop where you were?
No. Well, she was walking. She wouldn't know.
That's a long walk.
Yeah.
And you did that for your communion, up to your communion years?
Yeah. Dry weather like this, it was raining now, it was a different story, you know.
On the bus.
We're now going to head over to the north side, over to the Phibsborough area, and we're going to talk to a man called Pat Liddy. He is a legend in Dublin. He has published at least a dozen books on the history of Dublin. Anything he doesn't know about it, it's not worth knowing. But at the back of it all, he's very proud to be Dublin, and he has been a champion for Dublin history, its buildings, the city, for the last at least 25 years. So I caught up with Pat in early 2010 in the basement of Liberty Hall, of all places, and we had a little chat about Pat's early years in Dublin.
Now, I have to confess, I was born slightly outside the canal. I was born on Movey Road in an old nursing home there, but I was raised and spent most of my early life in Phibsborough, which is very definitely inside the boundary marked by the Royal Canal. So I'm a true Dubliner. That's the first thing. But as a Dubliner, I was always conscious of being a Dubliner because essentially most of my relatives were from County Meath. They were the other branch, the Culchi, dare I say, and I was the Jackeen. I suppose growing up as a child, I grew up in an inner city environment. And it's a very special environment. It's a place of terraced houses, of neighbours, of people dropping in and out, of bricks and mortar and tarmac Adam streets. You wouldn't see much in the way of trees and landscape like you would down the countryside. But it was a very special place. It was Dublin in my youth, Dublin of the fogs. Every November, December, the fogs would roll in because there was so much in the way of smoke coming out of people's chimneys. Everybody had a coal fire. That was very much the smell of Dublin in the winter time that I so enjoyed. But of course, people who suffered from chest problems, that was killing them. In any case, spending my life around Phibsborough, exploration was another great bonus of living in my part of Dublin, because we did have some greenery. We did have some of a sense of rural Ireland because we had the canal and we had the railway. And I would spend all of my young years floating around the environments of the canal, crossing the locks, just looking at the old barges rotting there behind the great mills that we had in Phibsborough, walking up into areas that have since been built in the Glasnevin area, the Finglas area, the Cabra area. They were fields when I was a young chap. And just enjoying this openness, this environment, and the safety that Dublin was in the 40s and 50s. Your parents didn't worry excessively about you being out on your own, and you were out with your friends. Yeah. It was just a wonderful place to run around and explore.
And yes, what a powerful descriptive narrative there from Pat of his early days in Phibsborough, a talent he was going to go on and use today, not only in his books, but also in his walking tours of Dublin. People come from all over the world to be brought around Dublin by Pat. His narratives are absolutely spellbinding. We're going to talk a little bit now about modern Dublin and what he thinks of Dublin today. Here are his thoughts on that.
Dublin is one of the few cities where in the middle of the rush, the traffic, the commerce, the activity, you just have to walk a few yards and all you will hear is birdsong. I mean, you mentioned St. Stephen's Green. I think even more favourite with me would be Merrion Square Park and all the beautiful Georgian terraces that are kept in a manicured fashion. I've taken so many tours to Merrion Square and they've just said how immaculately well kept that park is, how the grass is cut, the beautiful flowers in all seasons. So our park surely would be one of my great joys, the Phoenix Park, the world's biggest city enclosed park. And that's just an extraordinary place with new discoveries to be made there every time you go into it. The fact that Dublin is such a low-rise city, I don't mind skyscrapers. I just don't want skyscrapers at every street that you enter into. Especially in our northern hemisphere, it would be a shadowed city, which you would never see the sun. The odd skyscraper here and there. But the fact that we have a city of 4, 5, 6, 7 stories maximum, I think is one of the joys of walking around the streets. Another thing that I love in Dublin, as well as some iconic buildings like Sunlight Chambers, like the Bank of Ireland, even Trinity College itself, is the fact that I don't think I can go into town without meeting somebody I know. So again, it's this thing that we often say that Dublin is really a series of villages. It's completely true. You just go around and it might be somebody you meet on just a nodding acquaintance. It might be somebody that you say, come on, have you time for a cup of coffee? That to me is the Dublin I love.
Before I said goodbye to Pat, I really, really had to talk to him about his art. He was a little bit reluctant to talk about it, the self-effacing, shy guy that he is, about that particular talent, but I twisted his arm and I asked him to tell me, when did it all begin for him?
I say I was about 10 years of age. And it stayed with me up till about 14 or 15, and then it just seemed to evaporate and dissolve. I was always tinkering around with watercolours. Even before I was selling any, I would do a watercolour and just put it in a frame and hang it up where I was living at home. And then I remember, gosh, what did I give my wife for her birthday? And I gave her a painting of Venice. We had just come back from Venice. And I gave her a nice little, quite a small little watercolour of Venice. And we still have that, and it's a lovely memory. I was doing them for fun, really. I went to the Philippines in the early 1970s, and I was going around with my sketch pad in the Philippines at a time of great change also in the Philippines, and I was going around rural villages and sketching houses on stilts and so forth. And people didn't object to that. They don't like tourists coming in with their camera and just taking a quick click, which is almost kind of undercover and running away again with it. But if you go in and you sit on a stool or sit on an old case or something, in with the people in their village and the children are playing around you and so forth, and you're doing a sketch, they kind of think you're taking time to be with them and to value their way of life and so forth. So I used to enjoy that very much, doing drawings when I was abroad. But these are only for fun and for myself. They're just hanging at home. But when I was doing a building or a place or a collection of buildings or a street in Dublin, I see these as kind of portraits. You'll get somebody who will do a face or do a still life. To me, a building is not... An architect can draw a building, but it wouldn't have personality. And what I try and do is take the building, look at it, and search for its personality. And every building says something. And that's what I try to capture, either as a watercolour or as a sketch.
Before I parted company with Pat, I asked him to comment on Raised on Songs and Stories, the oral tradition, the historian that I am, collecting songs, poems and stories from Dublin, and the comparison between my role and what he does himself as an artist.
Well, first of all, there are 1.5 million stories in Dublin. For every person that lives in Dublin or calls himself a Dubliner, there's a story. And that has never changed. The lovely thing is, Dublin is still a people's place. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And I hope it always remains like it. But Dublin is going through change. It's going through vast change. One of the things any historian or artist can do is to give people something to reflect on. Just think twice before making that leap. There are things to be learned from our predecessors. I mean, all I am doing is reflecting either the genius or the vision or what other people have done in the past. And I'm only interpreting it in my own way and trying to remind people what great minds before us have done. And they can't always have been wrong. But we can make mistakes if we don't listen to the voices of the past. And those voices of the past will guide us to the future.
Raised on songs and stories.
That brings us to the end of the programme today. I hope you had a good listen, so don't forget and tune in next week, same time, for Gerry Cooley, Near 90 FM, for Raised on Songs and Stories.
Dublin town, the hallowed halls and houses, the haunting children's rhymes, that once was Dublin city in the rain.
This program was made with the support of Sound and Vision, Broadcasting Funding Scheme, a BCI initiative.